This is the third thing I have spilt in the same day. So we'll, I think I got so excited about that ice cream social. Are y'all having hot fudge?
Yes.
Okay, we'll get through this real quick. My name is Debbie Harris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And I'd like to thank Janice and everybody involved with me being here this weekend to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. I always consider it a real privilege to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, but when I'm asked to tell my story, I take it as a real responsibility, because the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous to me is a place of respect, and I don't take it lightly, and this is not a place for me to spout off my opinions or anything like that. I'm here simply because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's been sober for a period of time as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you are new here, I hope that you'll try to find the similarities instead of the differences. And I know, because when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked for the differences, because I wasn't an alcoholic and certainly didn't want to be one. But I welcome you here, whether you're returning or here for your first time. I hope you'll try it the way it's written in our book. Those are the instructions from me, and they have worked very well for a period of time. And so I'd like to thank the committee and my wonderful hostesses for having me here. There's three things I like to tell you about me first, because these are always the three things I like to know about you. And I find that with these three things in my life generally works very comfortably on the inside and works pretty well. It's when I start running my own life that I get uncomfortable, and the signs are very obvious to me. And so these three things are important to me. First is sobriety date. My sobriety date is February the 8th, 1976, which means in a couple of days, God willing, and one day at a time, I'll be 17 years sober. And the thing about that to me that kind of gives me chills is I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous at age 17. I didn't stay sober from that time on, but I was introduced, so I've almost been sober half of my life. That's not my first sobriety date, but it is my last one. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous and don't have a sobriety date, I encourage you to get one. Alcoholics Anonymous will make a lot more sense when you're sober. And to me, being sober is the absence of everything, regardless if it's alcohol or whether it be in tablet or smoking or snorting or shooting form, because the last thing I ever took on the 7th of February was I smoked one lousy joint. And that's the last thing I have taken to this date. And because there has got to be one thing in my life that is honest and above reproach and without question, and that has got to be my sobriety date. I don't ever want to stand up in my home group and take a cake for a period of time and think to myself, which is the worst person to know, gee, I wonder if I should have counted taking such and such. I don't ever want to test myself. I don't ever want to get that close to being uncomfortable about my length of sobriety and questioning if that's really my true date or not. I've seen too many people do that, and a lot of them end up drunk. The second and third thing to me are equally important. I just can't say them at the same time, and one of them is a home group. And I'm currently a member of the Bellflower Big Book group and have been for over 6 years since I moved out there. Prior to that, I was a member of the Skyline group in Atlanta for almost 7 years, which I just visited this past week. And my original home group was the 12 and 12 group in Minneapolis. I've always believed in a home group, and not for their benefit, but for mine. Having a home group and a commitment there and has shown me how to develop consistency, showing up whether I want to or not. It has given me an opportunity to be of service without recognition. It has shown me how to learn to be one among many. It has shown me how to be of service in all areas of my life. And to me, a home group is important. And if you don't have one of those, I hope you get one soon. And the third thing is a sponsor. I've had three sponsors in sobriety because I've lived in three different states. I believe in sponsorship. I have the opportunity to sponsor some girls. I wouldn't dream at 16 years of sobriety being without a sponsor, because you know, maybe you're new, or maybe you've not had a sponsor for a long time. and maybe you don't know how to ask people or what to look for. Well, I don't know about for you, but for myself, the three people I've had as a sponsor have had many things in common. They've all had long-term sobriety, and they've all been excellent members of Alcoholics Anonymous, active. They don't give it lip service, they give it action. But probably the top of the list that all of them had in common or have in common still, they're all still alive and active members of AA, is they're all people I would like to be like when I grow up. They are all outstanding in the results of Alcoholics Anonymous working in their life. They wear it well. And so those three things, if you are restless, irritable, and discontent tonight, and you are missing one or all of these three things, I hope you get them soon, because I will guarantee you this, that when you implement them and have them in your life will begin to change. And I don't know about you, but I like being comfortable on the inside. And these three things make that happen for me. I had my first drink the same night as my first drunk. I was 12 years old. It was a Friday the 13th. Fridays have always been my favorite night of the week from that point on. And I was April of 1970. Now that makes me 35 today, so we'll get the numbers out of the way. I'm always counting. I assume you do too. So I had my first drink, but I, as a friend of mine says, if my environment would have predicted whether or not I'd be an alcoholic, I would not be an alcoholic. I would be the first person I saw drunk. I was raised in Middle America, in the Midwest. I was an only child. I didn't want or lack for anything. I had a comfortable, loving, caring home. I was raised in the Catholic school my first 5 years. I was raised up in the Catholic Church. I didn't see violence or abuse of any sort whatsoever. My parents were people I would identify as social drinkers. Absolutely no reason for me to drink. I didn't feel unusually weird or odd or strange. No reason for me to take a drink and want to get drunk. And yet when I was invited to this party that was coming up on Friday night, that's exactly what I wanted to do. You see, I didn't know how to do these things, but they had invited me to this party, and I'd heard them talking about drinking. And somehow, somewhere along the line, I decided that, well, this is like my debut. I mean, I get one shot at being a part of this group, and this is it. And if they're talking about drinking, then somehow I have to get drunk, because that's going to be the most or the best or the ultimate that I can get, and I can't mess this up. And yet, I never saw how you did that. I just somehow figured that you drink a lot to get there, and because my parents certainly were not alcoholics by a long shot. And we are unable to find any in our family. We didn't have any aunts and uncles we didn't talk about. I mean, no one had a problem with drinking whatsoever. You see, the kind of drinking that I saw was my parents, and they would have company over. They needed a reason to drink. So every now and then company would come over, and they would take down that dusty whiskey bottle, that God knows how long it had been up there. They had booze last for years. I mean, until I started to drink. They had lasted a long time. And they would pour their guests a drink, one, and they would put in the ice and mix and foo-foo and whatever else they did, and then they'd cap it and shove it for another undetermined amount of time. And they would drink and nurse that drink all night long. And they'd have dinner and play cards, and then because they'd been drinking, they'd have coffee and sandwiches before they would drive home. And I mean, who drinks like that? You know, I mean, I have never drank like that. I've never thought about drinking like that. And I'd be embarrassed to drink like that, you know? Why bother? And so that was the way they drank. And yet it never, ever, I can say that, occurred to me to drink like that. Because you see, the way that I would drink, which was as would be as natural to me as this was to them, is I would take that fresh whiskey bottle, uncap it, and toss the cap, because I'll never need it again. I will drink that bottle that night as quickly as I can. And I didn't think anything unusual about that, regardless of my age. When I arrived at that party, I had no idea that that night would absolutely change my life in every single area. When I walked into that room and started about 6 o'clock, it would set many patterns for me. It would be really as if I walked through a set of doors, and I never did, nor have I returned to the room that I left. My whole being, mental, emotional, spiritual, and everything, would change that night when I began to drink. And 6 and some years later, when I returned to Alcoholics Anonymous, it would change one more time again. And that way would become more natural to me. But when I arrived that night, it was a very important night to me. And as I said, I set many patterns for myself. I started at 6 o'clock, and I would always start as early as possible. And when you're 12 and 13 years old, it's sort of like a liquid potluck, you know, whatever y'all bring, you mix it up, pass it around, God knows what it is. But it would never make any difference to me what it was, whether it was liquor or beer or mixed or straight or out of a bottle or a glass with ice. It wouldn't make any difference. I would eventually have my favorites, but it would never really matter. But that particular night, I took that first drink, and when it went down, it burned. And I thought, this is good. That means it's working. You know, it was like some kind of a sign. And when it hit, that is not what I knew it was going to do. Because when it hit, it just sort of slowly moved about. And I didn't know I had a gut full of hot rocks until I heard them start to cool off a little bit. And I didn't know I was all twisted up and knotted inside until they started to unloosen themselves. And I think what makes me an alcoholic, because according to the doctor's opinion, men and women drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol, is what happened to me when I took the second drink. And from the second drink on, it would be different. You see, because when I took that second drink, I had arrived at the party that night very nervous and scared, and I hope everything's going to be okay, and I hope my hair looks all right, and I hope I don't say anything stupid. Oh, my God, there he is. I hope he'll talk to me. And when I took that second drink, the change happened. You sort of straighten up, put your shoulders back, and think, aren't they glad I'm here? You know? Boom! It just happened. That magic took over. I took that first drink to be accepted and approved by those people, and I took the second drink for the next 6 years on for the effect. Because nobody and nothing had ever had that effect on me. And nothing certainly that fast. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard Clancy put into words exactly what happened to me, and I knew exactly what he was talking about. And he described that it instantly changed my perception. Yes. Yes, it did. And I liked the perception it changed to. That night, I would have my first blackout, and because, see, everything was my first experience, I assumed everybody had this happen to them. I did not think you had anything different done. And so I figured this was regular or normal or social drinking or whatever you want to call it. And I didn't know it wasn't. I didn't know I'd be the only little kid that got drunk in that room that night. I didn't know I was the only one drinking as quickly as possible. But I had my first blackout, and I passed out for the first time. And just 3 hours after that first drink, I had been drug home from the party, and I had my first case of the dry heaves, and I wanted to get back to the party because, hey, I'd had a good time. Now, who knows what happened? Who cares? I have spent many hours in blackouts, and all of us will find people very happy to tell you what you did in them. You sort of wish they'd have a blackout now and then, too, you know. But this was my first night of experience, and I couldn't wait to do it again. From that night on, not anything I did or felt or thought did I give a second to regarding alcohol, because I couldn't wait to do it again. I lived for the next time and was living off the last time. Saturday morning, my awakening thoughts, I've just had my first drunk 12 hours ago, yet my awakening thoughts are, how can I get some more for tonight? And a few girlfriends and I did get caught, got some beer and got caught. And you see, I'm 12 years old, and it did not occur to me that perhaps I should wait. Maybe I am a little too young to be drinking, that maybe I should wait till I'm of legal age. Well, I'm here to tell you I've never had a drink of legal age. Every time I got there, they changed the age limit. And so I've never had a legal drink of alcohol, but that was not my solution. My solution was that I'm going to have to learn how to lie better and find a better hiding place. And that's what I have to remember. These are the kinds of solutions that I used to come up with. And they're pretty similar today. Basically, they don't work. My solutions never did, nor will they work. And so my drinking at that time mainly would be limited to weekends at every given opportunity, but all the change happened so fast in my attitude and how I felt about things. I had developed, I don't care, leave me alone, get away from me. Just so quickly, it even today when I think back how fast that happened, it just makes me spin because it was such a natural transition, and yet it was very startling to the people who had known me. And yet this was as natural to me as breathing, this way of thinking and living. About a year later, I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs, which allowed me to stay conscious longer before that inevitable blackout. I am a blackout drinker because I drink whiskey out of a bottle with a beer chaser. I'm not interested in fruit and umbrellas. I'm very serious about drinking. And I blacked out too quickly, and I like being in the middle of things. I like being, I want to stay awake. You know, I don't want to be sleeping through life. I want to be in the middle of it. And so I found things that would keep me awake. I found things like speed and acid would do those kinds of things. And so for my kind of diet and what I did as often as possible, and certainly for the last year and a half with very few exceptions on a daily basis, is my kind of a diet was a bottle of whiskey and a hit or two of acid. And that was my kind of day. That's the way I like to live. Well, 5 years and 3 weeks after my first drunk, on Friday, another Friday, May 2nd, 1975, my father, who had sought professional advice as to what to do with his daughter because he was tired of seeing her commit slow suicide, was advised to, while he still had legal rights over me, to commit me to a hospital for alcoholism and drug addiction, and that he did at age 17. And I would be in there a total of 7 weeks. I would learn a lot of information about alcoholism, and I mean, a language completely foreign to me. I'd never heard these kinds of words and terms and things like that. And on Fridays, we would be taken to outside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and since I'm not an alcoholic, there's really no need for me to sit up front, so I'd sit in the farthest back corner of the room I could stick myself in, because I didn't want to get too close, because I didn't want to be one. Because you see, those people don't drink. They not only don't drink, they don't drink forever. And at 17, forever is a very long time. I mean, you know. So I'm not interested in that. Plus, I know I'm going to drink again. I just don't know when or where. But probably the easiest way for me to qualify before I got sober was the things that I rationalized away. They would be doing exactly what I'm doing tonight, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I would rationalize these away, but my problem was, as this was the beginning of the end, that I was beginning to identify in my own small way with these people. They would say things like, they had lost their family because of drinking. Hey, I wanted to lose my family, you know? That was an asset. That was not a liability. I wanted to get them off my back. Hey, that was fine with me. And yet inside, I knew that my drinking had been a source of continuous, ongoing trouble and problems and heartache for that family and for everyone's welfare, mental, physical, and emotional. I needed to go. But I wanted them out of there. They talked about things like wrecking cars, totaling out cars. I had never totaled out a car, not officially. Big difference there. I had a little drunk car that arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they started off square when you drove them off the lot, and they kind of get personality bumps to them and round it out. But I'd never totaled out a car. That was the big difference. They talked about jails and institutions and prisons they'd been in, and I thought, my God, I mean, you know, there's some serious criminals in here. I mean, you know, people like my husband, Johnny, you know, sitting around these rooms, and I'm thinking, hey, You know, that's not, I've only been in jail 3 times, and every time it was a misunderstanding, you know. They talked about drunk driving charges. And, no, I'd never had any of those either. The reason I didn't have them is because I worked for the city judge. And when I would get stopped for drunk driving, because I am a driving drunk, I am all over town, I would get stopped. I knew all the police on the force. They would take my booze away and send me home. And that's why I didn't have any drunk driving charges. They talked about losing jobs. And I had to begin to remember. I had been fired from a few. I always seemed to have one. Some little job going somewhere. I had been fired from a few. I had been asked to quit from a few because of some extremely embarrassing behavior. But my problem was that I usually would quit in blackouts. Didn't know I'd quit, you know, so I'd go in the next day, you know. And those are awkward. Those are very awkward. Yeah. So these are the kinds of things that up here I would rationalize, but down here I'm starting to identify in my own small way with. There were 2 things, though, they said that I couldn't dance away, and one of them was they talked about all those broken promises. In the face of my father certainly came up in front of me, all those promises I had made to the point where I refused to make them anymore, because always on the tagline of the promise included the fact that I would not drink or take drugs, and that was impossible. And so I just quit making them, and that last year I tried to avoid him as much as possible. And the other thing they talked about, which probably frightened me the most, because it was one of those deep, dark things that really was identification, was they talked about trying to scrub away the smell. And that whole last year and a half or so, I had been trying to scrub away that smell, that elusive, crazy smell. I had no idea where it was coming from. I'd puff and powder and perfume, and it was still there, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And these people up here were saying that it was booze coming through their pores. These people are identifying as alcoholics. They're talking about this smell, and they're saying it's booze coming through their pores. And the thing that frightens me the most, really, is that I know that they know what that smell smells like. My grandmother doesn't know what that smell smells like, but I knew that they did. Now, I didn't get sober from that point on, but that scared me. That was a little too close to home. I was sent to an all-women's halfway house on a Friday in June of 1975. I arrived there. I'd be there a total of 9 months. In the first 7 months, I did just what I had to do to get by. And I've learned a lot of things about that time. Number one, that doesn't work. It never has worked for me, even before I was serious about sobriety, and it doesn't work when I am serious about sobriety. Doing just enough to get by. I have to do a little bit more just to feel equal. And I was told that I couldn't drink or take any drugs. Okay, I can do that. And I had to go to at least one Alcoholics Anonymous meeting a month. Okay, so I didn't drink or take drugs, and I went to one AA meeting a month, whether I needed it or not. I was too stupid to go to the movies and sign my own paper, so I'd go to these meetings and thought it was really great for you. And you see, during this period of time, I didn't change anything. I didn't change the way I looked, talked, acted, dressed, behaved, language, anything. I kept all those old phone numbers very fresh and current because I knew one day I'd be back there. And obviously, I wasn't going to stay sober under those kinds of conditions, because I learned that just because I don't drink and show up in a meeting now and then, I don't have sobriety. That is not conducive. I mean, I can not drink for a period of time, but I'm talking about being comfortable on the inside and not drinking. That's a combination that only Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me and made possible, to have those things at the same time. And so finally, I went to California for a 2.5-week holiday to visit my mother. In the first week, I was absolutely miserable because I wanted to drink, hung around people who drank, and last week and a half, I was right there with them. I was drunk to nobody's surprise, certainly, But what happened to me is that during that period of time, I remember being on the floor face down, physically so drunk I can't move, and I am drunk up to my eyeballs and as clear tonight as I am at the moment. And I was thinking about all those things I'd heard in AA and all those symptoms, and it was driving me crazy because they were just all magnified, that the inability to predict my behavior, the inability to control my drinking, the inability to do any of those things, the obsession, the craving, and all the kinds of things that just start everything going again. And yet, I knew they had been there from the first night I took a drink. And they were there right now, 6 years later or whatever. And yet, I just couldn't seem quite able to believe that I am an alcoholic. I kept trying to say, well, if only I was back there with old friends, old playmates, old playgrounds, it'd be different. I tried very hard to make it different. It's California. I mean, it's just the stuff out here. That must be it. But I had been in too many AA meetings, and I knew there wasn't any if only. If there weren't any, nothing would be different. And I returned to Minnesota, and I had learned my lesson. And that's how I kind of looked at it. And I stepped my meetings up from one a month to one a week. And when you're running your own life and sponsoring yourself, one meeting a week sounds like a lot of meetings to me. And so I went to one meeting a week. And finally, 5 weeks later, on a Friday, I got a letter in the mail with one joint. And like any still uncommitted alcoholic, I gave it about a 20-second thought and decided to keep it just in case. You know, the day may come when I might need it. I just didn't know it'd be the next day, you know. Naturally, I didn't think about anything else but that. And that next day was February 7th. And whatever your February 7th is, I never get tired of hearing about the story of the day that you got sobriety. Because I don't know how you can predict when you're going to get the gift of sobriety, and I believe it to be a gift. And I mean, it doesn't come without me taking some action, and as it says, picking up the spiritual kit of tools, I have to do something about it. But that was going to be my day. And wouldn't have been a day I picked. I'd have picked something easier to remember or something a little rhymey or cute or something, but it wasn't for me to pick that day. That day was I was going to be all done. I didn't know that morning when I woke up. I just had my mind to smoke that one joint, and that was all my life I had planned. And maybe it's because by the end of that day, I'd be willing to do it under somebody else's plan. For the first time in my life, I surrendered. I thought I'd surrendered lots of times, and obviously one lousy joint is not going to do much to you, but it did exactly to me what nobody and nothing could. It kicked me off the fence of reservation and indecision I didn't even know I'd been sitting on. I thought I'd surrendered. I thought I was doing it this way. But after this, I knew that I hadn't at all. This was much different. It was a different feeling inside. I was all out of answers and all out of questions, except one. How do you stay sober? For the first time, I was willing to do what you told me to do and willing to listen. I was willing to go the full route, not just partly. And I went to the old-timers of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I knew that I could not keep breathing and living and going on about my business the way I was. I couldn't do it. I was sick and tired of me. I was sick and tired of my own action, which was directionless and purposeless and absolutely with no meaning. And so I went to the old-timers of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to me, an old-timer was anybody who'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. And at 18 years old, there was a lot of them. There's at 35... still quite a few. They're kind of thinning out a little bit, but there's still a lot of them around. And I've always surrounded myself with old-timers. And so they told me then, almost 17 years ago, what they're still being told today and what's been told for all of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, first of all, we don't take anything that affects us one day at a time. We are regular in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get a guide of our understanding, we take these steps, we study the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we pass this on to others. Now I'll be the first to tell you that I have not from day one been a model member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 18 when I got sober, and I hadn't really done anything but drink. And now I'm just about to start living. And I have made lots of mistakes. I've May the lots of errors and moral and immoral and legal and illegal and all kinds of things throughout my sobriety. Hopefully I only have to do them one time because I don't like to pay for the pain that comes as a result of those things. But I have had a way of life to correct those things and to set right some wrongs. And I began the process of living. And it has helped. Alcoholics Anonymous helped me grow up. Not that I'm necessarily there, but it has watched me grow up. I was in meetings every night. I worked and I went to meetings. That's all I did for the first 4 years of my sobriety. And I had a sponsor, and she began to help me study the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which changed the face and the understanding and everything about it. And when I was almost 4 years sober, about a month shy of 4 years of sobriety, I moved to Atlanta. And I would be there almost 7 years. And when I arrived, I had a sponsor, and that I had asked before I arrived there. Many of you know Joe P. He was my sponsor during that period of time. And I made my home group, same as his home group, the Skyland group. And I did not utilize Joe those first few years effectively like I would later on and like I like to utilize a sponsor. I started making my own decisions. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but I decided, you know, I don't really know how they do stuff here in Atlanta. And so I'll go like to 2-3 meetings a week, kind of get myself slowly acclimated in here. And, you know, then I'll feel more comfortable. Well, let me just tell you, that is not the solution. The solution is a lot more meetings, not less meetings. But for me, when I decide it's going to be 2 or 3 meetings, it's usually 2. It's never 4. You know, I never bump the number up. It usually becomes 2 in a short period of time, and that's what happened. And I started going to 2 meetings a week and getting some sort of balance in my life, which about teetered me off the sobriety here, balanced me out of here. Dangerous. I would rather be out of balance because I go to too many meetings, because that's where I feel good and that's where I get well. And what happened is after 2 years, I'm 6 years sober, and I'm kind of restless, irritable, and discontent, and I'm not sure why, but as I can look at it today, I know exactly why. It's called my actions. Because when I had left Minneapolis, I was 4 years sober, and now I'm 6. And the actions were very clear to me, as I began to reflect after I got back on track. For my home group, and I still do this today, not every meeting, but my home group meeting, I like to get there an hour early because the meeting before the meeting is fun. And now I find 2 years later, it's 6 years spry, I'm getting there about 5 minutes before the meeting starts, getting my coffee and sitting down. If there happens to be a newcomer on my way to my seat, I'll shake their hand. And that's my pre-meeting involvement. And now I find that after the meeting, I used to be one of the last people to leave, because that part of the meeting is fun, too. And now I find that 6 years of sobriety is sort of like, amen, shake, shake, okay, see y'all next week, bye, and you're looking at taillights. And I'm wondering why I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I began to realize that I was treating Alcoholics Anonymous, a way of life, like I'm attending some cooking class or something. I might as well be. I'm treating it like a punch-in, punch-out thing. And we're talking my life here, and I'm giving it, my obligation is fulfilled. Very dangerous for me. What happened is about 3 weeks after my 6th birthday, I thought I discovered the reason why I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I met him. And I have seen, the reason I share this year is for a lot of reasons. I don't ever want to do this again. It was the worst year of my sobriety to date. I just don't ever want to become this again. And I have seen it happen to people, whether it be with men or women or parents or children or their job or their car or money. It's called obsession. And obsession is so dangerous and so potentially deadly, it is unbelievable, regardless of what or who your obsession is. Well, mine happened to be about a little fella. And I had met him on a Friday night. I thought that was an omen. He was single. That was good. He had a lot of money. That was even better. And gosh, he's sober 13 years. Now, he hadn't been to a meeting in 3 years, but hey, no problem. I'll help him. And I set out to help this little fellow, whether he wanted it or not, and he didn't. But that didn't stop me. I persevered. I figured he'd change his mind, be very glad that he did. I'll tell you, for the next 3 months, I was absolutely an insane woman on the inside. I think I looked okay on the outside, but on the inside, it was a nut house. What I saw was that 7 years prior, my whole life revolved around alcohol and drugs, the who, what, when, where, and why of it. Everything in my life revolved around that. And not too long later, it said almost, 6 years of sobriety, it's revolving around a human being. And that is a very, very dangerous way for me to live. I was not getting the results that I wanted. I was instructing God daily of his duties. He was not following through. I was trying to maneuver and manipulate the universe, and it was not happening. I would sit in front of a mirror and lie to myself, knowing I'm lying to myself, trying to make believe. During this period of time, I thought about some very destructive things to get attention. I became jealous and all kinds of very devious thinking. I didn't carry anything out, but I just had all that kind of crap inside. And the destructive things I think about suicide. Temporary suicide, of course, nothing permanent, I thought about running my car against those guardrails. I thought about getting drunk at him, and very, very sick, sick things. And I was ready and had sold out in a lot of areas of my life, but I had about a half ounce of sanity left that knew this. The minute I make the first excuse not to go to the meeting, my second excuse is going to come twice as fast. And I was terrified about making that first excuse because I knew I'd be drunk. I was just on such a fine line. I was too terrified, but I was certainly no model member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I'd come in crying, I'd leave crying. Do not offer the solution. I really like the problem, thank you. I just was not one to give hope to the newcomer, let me tell you. It was a dreadful way to live. And I tried, and I should be better than this. I'm such a sick person. I should be more spiritual. What is wrong with me? Running my own life is what's wrong with me. And I didn't want to talk to my sponsor about it because I really wasn't interested in direction to get well. I mean, you'd think I'd want to be, but for some reason I didn't. I wanted to have it my way, and I wasn't getting my way, and that's how it was coming out. And so what happened is that after 3 months of this whirlwind romance, of which I was the only one involved, God had thrown me lots of roadblocks, of course. Denied those, they were misplaced. Finally, he threw one at me I could not deny, and the guy got married to somebody else. But I was a good sport. I let him go. And, big of me. And it was like I went around the block, and hey, bingo, there was another little fellow, very similar in situation to him, did this little dance for another 3 months, and married him off to somebody else as well. Well, I'd had about enough of this action, and I was just what bottomed out. I just had come crashing down emotionally again. And at almost 7 years of sobriety, I just surrendered big time again. And I just couldn't, one more time, I couldn't stand my own action. I couldn't stand the way I was living on the inside. And the only way I knew to get a solution was through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew I was at that fork. The next step is going to determine sobriety or getting drunk. And I wanted to be sober a lot more than I wanted to be drunk. So I few weeks later, happened to be at a convention, and on Friday night I heard people, places, and things don't make me happy. And the speaker's referring to his drinking days. I'm looking at almost 7 years of sobriety thinking, my God, that's exactly where I am now. I'm looking for people, places, and things to make me happy. Although I altered the words to fit me more appropriately to be men, money, and mansions don't make me happy. But not that any of those things are right, wrong, left, or bad, or anything. It's what I wanted to do with them was abuse them. And that is why these things were removed from my life. The other thing I heard was on Saturday night, and the speaker was talking about that if you've got some family business to take care of, you better take care of it before they die and you say you wish you would have. And that brought up the last amend I had to make, and the most difficult one, to my stepmother. And I knew now was the time, and I went back and I began to take these steps with my sponsor anew, just like I'd never done them before, and with new eyes and with a new feeling and a new spirit about it. And I, for like a Christmas present to me that year, I made amends to my stepmother, and I became current for the first time. I was all current. And I'm current today. I even got to, when I was in Atlanta, there was some odds and ends, little fringe business that I got an opportunity to clear up and take care of, and I feel very good about that. But I'm very current today, and I live comfortably on the inside. But I did that, and I felt so good about what had happened. I felt all the way down to my toes. I know that I have taken these steps, and they're part of my life, and on goes the cloud, and everything is wonderful and candy-coated, and I'm 8.5 years sober, sitting in a meeting wondering, why can't the enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety just always be here? I mean, why does it seem to come and go, and some days are up, some days are kind of dreary? And I'll tell you, I will be forever grateful that I didn't stumble around, get a cup of coffee, or somebody have to get up and go to the bathroom and make me miss what I heard. Because I think that if I wouldn't have heard this, you'd have a different speaker here. Because what this man said, it wasn't wooey, I don't mean to make it sound wooey and dramatic, it's just that he really saved my life. And I don't ever want to be the person who makes you miss what you need to hear, because I don't know what it is. But this man was talking about being restless, irritable, and discontent with some period of time of sobriety. And he said that he realized he was trying to live today in last year's program. And it just made me shiver. I thought, my God, that's what I've been doing for a year and a half. I made that amend a year and a half ago, and I haven't done that much since. That this is the day that I have to participate in life. This is the day that I have to show up and make some kind of a contribution. This is the day that there aren't any badges or medals that I can kind of polish up at night and adorn myself with every day and say, okay, now this is when I took my inventory, and then, oh yeah, over here is this amend. Or when I picked a newcomer up 5 years ago, you know, I mean, there aren't any of those kinds of badges and medals that I adorn myself. But yet, there are badges and medals in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you where I found them. I found them 16, almost 17 years ago in the eyes of the old-timers. Because you see, I believe the eyes are the window of the soul. And I looked in their eyes and I saw in them things I didn't have. I saw things like a peace about them on the inside, and I knew that it was not chemically induced. I saw them standing still in their own skin, and I didn't know how you did that. They had a God about them, and they didn't have to even tell me about him because it was obvious. You see, these are the badges and medals of Alcoholics Anonymous that we wear that are only a result of the steps and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous applied in our life. We don't have to tell anybody Alcoholics Anonymous works. It's obvious. I live today with some peace on the inside. I know that the things that are good and decent about me, and how to live like and behave like a lady, and how to live with some decency and dignity and grace, is how you've shown me how to live. That you've shown me life and sobriety are good through the ups and the downs and the lefts and the rights. Life goes on. I am not immune to life or life's tragedies, nor life's joys. And I've had them all, and more joys than sadness. And I've learned how to do things here that I didn't know how to do. You've shown me how to walk straight and tall, and how to hold my head up and not look at the floor anymore. You've shown me how to do this. For showing me how to live this as a way of life, I shall forever be indebted to you, and I thank you.